and welcome back, everyone, to the Research VR podcast, the podcast behind the science and design of virtual reality. I am your host, Oz Balabanian, and with me today is special guest, project manager at Noah Labs, Noah Zirkin. Hello, Noah.
Hey, how's it going, Oz?
Great. And of course, you have beaming in from Germany, Mr. Peter Leckoff.
Well, good morning, everyone.
Yes, it's a good morning indeed. We are actually doing, for the first time, also a video podcast at the same time, because our guest is going to be doing a little show and tell with his webcam of some of the hardware and the gear that he's been playing with, including the project, the Leap Motion project North Star, which we've talked about on this podcast many a times. It's an open source AR headset that has had us inkling and tingling at our fingertips to getting our hands in AR. And all the other, there's actually a few other AR headsets that you, Noah, are quite familiar with. So we're going to use this opportunity to have you on the podcast to talk about what it takes to build a Project North Star, how it works, how it feels, and what you've been doing with it.
Okay.
Yeah. So let's start kind of at the beginning. How did you find yourself in this realm of virtual reality and augmented reality, and how you're working here?
Okay. It's kind of a long story. I'll try to abridge it. I suppose I first heard the term augmented reality while on a summer camp field trip to the MIT Media Lab. And I was 14, and Steve Mann and Thad Starner were there at the time, and we actually got to have a little Q&A session with Thad Starner, who, if you guys don't know, ended up on the Google Glass team and has been a real research luminary in wearable computers for a really long time. So I think he mentioned AR.
Year was this?
This would have been 94.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we're going way back.
Yep. I think they had just gotten their hands on a Virtual Boy, which we got to try out. Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds about right. Yeah.
Yep. He was rocking a Twiddler 2 cording keyboard. It might have even been the Twiddler 1 at the time.
What kind of keyboard was it?
It's basically a pistol grip cording keyboard, so you input different letters.
The one from Nintendo?
No. I forget the company behind it, but there are three columns of four buttons, I believe, and the characters are different combinations of those buttons. And so it goes into a little holster, and I think the more recent ones have a little trackball on top. Anyway, he was wearing a little computer in a fanny pack and had a little monochrome headset hot glued to some safety glasses. He'd cut a hole in these safety glasses and put a little display on there. Would have been one of the first sort of micro displays, I guess, something akin to the viewfinder on an old camcorder. And and then he had this pistol grip keyboard, and I was just like, wow, this is the coolest thing, you know, ever. And I was sort of into sci-fi concepts like heads up displays, power armor, stuff like that, sure. You know. So as a 14-year-old into this kind of thing, I was just like, wow, this stuff actually exists. There are people working on it. And in the case of AR, there's a term to describe it. And then let's see, years later. So I then, you know, had I ended up working in, I had a few odd jobs, including for TechServe, which was a computer retailer in New York. It was the first Mac store, maybe in the country, and was the store that Apple based the whole Genius Bar model on. But After leaving there, I got introduced to the Arduino by So I really started out with hardware.
Were you into like early, you know, HMDs as well, like DK1, DK2, from a hardware perspective?
Yeah, actually.
Or are we talking before?
So the first arguably VR headset that I had was a Vuzix VR 920. The tracking on it was pretty awful because I think it was entirely magnetometer based. There was an accelerometer and a magnetometer in it, no gyro. So, it was a pretty low update rate. Yeah, it was awful. But
was it augmented reality or VR?
So
VR.
So it was VR, and it was basically video glasses with a partial IMU in there. So just the accelerometer and magnetometer, and of course, for a high refresh rate on high update rate on an IMU, you really need the gyro there. And actually, they ended up. I basically electrical taped a webcam to the top of that to do pass through AR, and was running it from a laptop in my backpack. And then Paul Travers, the CEO of Vuzix, ended up releasing a webcam specifically to go onto the front of that device for doing pass through AR. And I think I have serial number one of that camera, at least.
What sort of latency did a system like that have for the pass through AR?
Well, it was pretty brutal. I mean, of course, it depended on the on the computer itself. I think it was better than VGA, the camera, but maybe 1024 by 768, and it was.
But in terms of like latency,
Of latency, I honestly,
that's a killer.
I honestly don't recall it for the pass through itself. So the CV stuff that I was running on it was pretty awful because I was doing it in processing, so it was all Java based, using a library called Myron CV, I think, and J Myron it was called, and so that introduced a fair bit of latency, but the latency on the video itself wasn't so bad that it compromised my ability to use it. So I actually went out into public wearing this thing. I rode the New York City subway with it a couple of times, really freaked people out.
Do you by any chance know the anime code series experiment lane? Because particularly in the beginning, when you today, in the beginning of the show, described the situation where he had like this pocket computer, like what you're describing is 101, the scene where the guy literally uploaded his consciousness into the IP protocol, sticks some computers to his body, basically walks like a cyborg and creeps the hell out of people. Must have been really fearful for those people, right? Oh, Alexa. Alexa.
I love the German Alexa.
Yeah, sorry, it wasn't Alexa. So were people like freaked out by it, or?
I got a lot of strange looks. I mean, there's always weird stuff going on the New York City subway. Actually, I've got a weird encounter to tell you about from the New York City subway as well. I don't think most of the people on the train had ever seen anything like that before. And it was pretty odd, but it was fun. I sort of like.
Do you think today's it would react differently, or?
Yeah, probably. I didn't get anybody speaking to me or asking me questions. I think nowadays they would. At this point, everybody's familiar with VR headsets. If they haven't tried them, at least they've seen them. And so I think people would engage with me. At the time, people were just looking at me like an alien.
Right. Okay. So let's get into kind of like the more recent developments. I'm guessing you kept yourself familiar with VR headsets that were coming out, perhaps even a HoloLens and a Magic Leap. But what drew you to actually, I don't know are you the first? You might not be the first that built a North Star, or how many people in the world have built this open sourced project North Star? And kind of give us the maybe a broader context if I don't know it already.
So as far as I know, the first project North Star built outside of Leap Motion was built by a team at a company called Exi in Japan. And there is actually a pretty big Japanese enthusiast community around North Star at this point. They recently had a meetup, and I think they had 10 different units there that people had built, and they were all different variants. Every single one of them was unique, which was very cool to see. And because it's this open source project, of course, people are going to fork it into all kinds of different things. And so Exi's was a fork because they ended up using these displays that were originally intended for the Raspberry Pi, not the extremely high refresh rate, low latency displays that were prescribed by Leap Motion.
They must have been really basically not suited for this case, right? I mean, usually those Arduino Raspberry Pi screens are like the cheapest one you can get, right?
So the displays they were using at first, I don't think they were using the SPI-driven displays. I think they did have HDMI in. So it wasn't so bad. Yeah. Basically a smaller variant, I think somewhere around here. I have like a 6-inch Raspberry Pi display. But
Can you also describe kind of in general how the North Star works? Because, I mean, just looking at the videos of you wearing it, perhaps some people, including us, like don't fully understand primarily how do optics work? How does the display work?
Okay. So the optics path is pretty simple.
Nice. Noah is now showing us the North Star that he has built by himself. If you want to see this, this is on our YouTube page. So look up Research VR Podcast on YouTube and you will watch this.
Yeah. And if you ever looked at the Magic Leap and have been thinking in only pictures, man, I'm disappointed. I'm looking right now in this project North Star and I'm like, I want to have it on my head right now.
Cyberpunk AF. Yeah. Yes. tell us more.
it is Cyberpunk AF. That said, I don't want to badmouth Magic Leap or anything because because they have a variable focal depth in a way that nobody else does at this point. Maybe to a certain degree, right? It may not be. It may not be the light field display that we were led to believe they were going to be releasing.
Exactly.
And yes, I was disappointed with it. That said, they have variable focal depth, and nobody else does. That situation is probably going to change in a few days at MWC.
With Microsoft.
Exactly, yes. With HoloLens 2.
We're all looking for it, yeah.
Yep. That was a funny encounter, too. I mentioned to you guys before the podcast, before we started recording, that I was just skiing in Whistler near Vancouver a few days ago. And I was getting a drink in a bar with my father, and I overheard two guys next to me talking about industrial IoT. And, you know, in my day job, we do, we build industrial IoT projects, and I'm actually managing one right now. So I said, hey, what kind of project are you guys working on, and so forth? And they said, well, actually, we're with Microsoft. And one of them's like, yeah, I'm on the Azure IoT team. And I'm like, cool, I might be calling on you. Let's exchange contact info. And my father chimes in and goes, maybe you should tell them about the AR stuff. And one of the guys goes, oh, yeah, I was on the HoloLens team. And so that ended up being an interesting conversation in that, you know, I had some people to ask them, hey, do you know this person or that person? Actually, Microsoft ended up recruiting my roommate from back in New York to be one of the UI designers for HoloLens, which is funny because I think I introduced him to the concept of AR.
Nice. Doing the good deeds.
Quite a long time ago. And then he goes, hey, I got a job with Microsoft. And I'm like, what are you going to be doing? He's like, I can't tell you. And like 3 years later, HoloLens drops. And he's like, that's what I was doing. I'm just son of a, you know, but
we should, by the way, we should for sure talk about the HoloLens too, at least what we can speculate or what we would like maybe towards the end of the podcast. Hopefully this will come out before the announcement in March. So yeah,
if not, you all can know that we failed miserably with our predictions. or not.
Yeah, this could be a great time capsule. So
sorry about the digression. So
This is a podcast. Yes.
Okay. Cool. I could go on about. I have lots of funny anecdotes like that, and that is one of my least strange random encounters with people in the industry. The most notable one was running into Sergey Brin on the New York City subway. You guys have probably seen the photo that I took of him. Maybe not.
Is it a famous photo?
Yeah, it's a famous photo. Okay. It's Brin on the subway wearing glass before it was released, wearing a beanie and has like a plastic, you know, Chinese food bag. And
I have it here. Let me pull it up on the video.
Yeah, if you just look up Sergey Brin subway, you'll find that picture.
All right. Cool. So back to Leap Motion.
Yes. So the reflectors are it's actually a freeform reflector, and it was, I believe, the first iteration of the design was done by a guy named Adam, and I'm trying to. I don't remember his last name off the top of my head. And he actually ended up partnering up with, I think David Holtz recruited him to Leap Motion specifically to work on North Star. And I think he designed, on all aspects of it, actually. So he also did the first iteration, if not of the display driver board hardware, at least the firmware. So if you dig through the Analogix library code for the display driver firmware, a lot of the files have his name on it. So I think he did basically all of the initial configuration of that. So he wasn't just doing the optics design. So so the optics are... have a 50-50 reflective coating on the inside. The particular lenses that I have, I believe it's a silver-based coating. And then there's a protective coating over that. And then on the outer surface, that secondary surface, you have an anti-reflective coating. The anti-reflective coating on this one isn't perfect, so you do get a little bit of secondary reflection. So that's sort of a very slight ghost image of what you actually want to be there, just slightly behind it. There are more perfect anti-reflective coatings, and I'm looking into having them improve the one that's on the lenses that we're producing.
I think I read somewhere on Reddit that there was someone mass producing for the community those lenses. That's right.
That would be me. That would be nice. So
perfect.
Yeah. So when I first started looking into building the North Star headset, the whole promise of this project is that it can be built for around $100. Right. And that's what's so intriguing about it. You know, when when something like the Magic Leap costs, what is it, $2,500 And HoloLens costs $3,000 and so forth. Price is a big factor in the accessibility of optical pass-through AR. And when Leap Motion came along and said, hey, we've got a reference design that you can build for $100, well, that certainly piqued my curiosity, of course. I ended up, I was a little skeptical about it, but I was waiting for them to release those open source plans. Now, I originally came to China. I guess we didn't mention this, but I'm based in Shenzhen. I'm based in Shenzhen, China, where there are lots of supercars.
Shenzhen biker gang.
So that's kind of funny. I don't know if I can mention this. Two-wheeled motor vehicles, gas-powered two-wheeled motor vehicles in...
Are they outlawed?
Are verboten. That said, there are some motorcycles on the roads. I've been told that the former chief of police here has a biker gang, that he and his friends drive around on motorcycles, which is,
okay.
You know, you can interpret that however you want. You can decide what you want that to say
they're
about
probably
China.
Electric,
but,
right?
That
means they're probably electric.
No, they aren't. I don't know if you guys have ever watched the like ADV China YouTube series. You know, they motorcycle around China and sort of give commentary about it while they're doing so over there. Well, intercoms.
Nice.
But most of the you can have a motorcycle in China, but not inside the tier one cities. And so. That said, I don't know if I should say this. I do ride around on an electric motorcycle in Shenzhen, and it is technically very illegal. I seem to be getting away with it somehow.
Sorry, before we move on, is it you said all two-tiered vehicles in Shenzhen are
two-wheeled?
Two-wheeled, sorry.
No. So electric bikes are legal, but I think they can't go over 25 kilometers an hour. So you can pedal a normal bicycle faster than that. And it has to have pedals, and it can't weigh more than some ridiculously small number of kilos. The motor has to be under 300 watts, I think. Maybe it's lower than that. My bike has a 1,500 watt motor on it, and which is still pretty low, but it's incredibly well tuned.
Exactly.
It's got a Bosch controller and Bosch motor on it, and it gets up to
basically all electric bicycles have no Bosch motors.
Well, a lot of them.
Not in China.
Most of them are domestic. So, and an electric bike with a Bosch motor on it here is sort of a luxury item.
You're in the hardware capital. Yeah, you're in the hardware capital of the world, where that's where people go to prototype. That's where they have their prototyping teams. That's where they can print these very quickly, or even the raw materials are accessible. Yeah. Is that kind of where you found yourself to be?
Well, so I originally came to Shenzhen as part of Hacks. Back then, it was called Hackcelerator. So it was the first hardware startup accelerator in the world. And I was pretty early on, batch three, of Hacks. So in the way I got introduced to it, another anecdote, a friend of mine, Zach Hogan, he was the, brains behind MakerBot and, used to run the RepRap Research Foundation. He was based out of NYC Resistor, a hackerspace in New York. And, he had left MakerBot over the fact that they had gone closed source on certain parts of their most recent printer. And so he ended up being one of the co-founders of this hardware startup accelerator in Shenzhen. And he was the resident engineer there. So I was building a wearable input device for controlling heads-up displays because I hated that I had to swipe on the side of my head to use Google Glass. drove me nuts. Drove me so crazy that I decided to go to China and build a remote control for the thing. And was sort
for the glass.
Yeah, for Google Glass. So I ran off to China to do that. I had a wearable input device that I had been building for years before. It was actually sort of the descendant of a data glove that I built quite a long time ago, maybe 10 years ago. And that was sort of hyped by Ori Inbar, who ended up going on to found AWE, previously known as ARE. So he and I go way back. I had this wearable input device that was IMU based, it was sort of a partial data glove. So I came here to commercialize that, and then ended up doing something slightly different instead, which is a combination trackpad air mouse. I'll show you guys that on the video in a little bit. But so I came to China to build that, a wearable input device for controlling heads up displays. And so years later, I ended up sort of getting stuck here for different reasons, and ended up working for this company, Noah Labs, which is not my company.
How is it not?
It is so weird. You know, maybe it had something to do with why I applied for the job. So I guess I've sort of become a mascot of the company, but but it had the name before I worked here. So I ended up working for this product development company, Noah Labs. I've got a team of electrical engineers, mechanical engineers, and firmware engineers at my disposal. And I sort of dabble in all of those, but they're better at all of those things than I am. So LeapMotion announces this reference design and puts out these really intriguing videos. Maybe a month later, month and a half later, I was in town in San Francisco for Maker Faire and AWE. And they were having an event at the local Hacks office in San Francisco. And I pop in for that, and I run into Cyril Ebbesweiler, who is was one of the founders of Hacks, and also happens to be one of the first investors in LeapMotion. So now it had been a few months later. LeapMotion had already said, "Hey, we're about to release this reference design," and then didn't. And so I went over and pulled Cyril aside, and I said, "Hey, could you talk to your friends over at Leap? I'm really psyched for this design, but where is it? Are they actually going to open source it?" He said, "Well, that's still the plan. We'll see." I said, "Well, how is it? You know, I heard that Magic Leap 1 hadn't dropped yet, but I'd been told by somebody that, hey, it's actually just going to use layered waveguides, not some more exotic light field system." And so I mentioned that to Cyril, and I'm like, "So, you know, can this thing begin to compare?" And he goes, "This is so much better. I've tried it, and it's so much better. Just be patient. It's coming." And sure enough, it did. And I'm looking at this reference design, and yes, all of the components are cheap in mass production, but if you want to get these lenses made, you have to have them. Probably the most straightforward way to do it, and the way that LeapMotion did it, was to have it diamond turned, so milled with a diamond tip out of a block of acrylic, PMMA plastic.
Okay.
And
sounds expensive.
It is expensive, several hundred bucks at least. unless you happen to have a diamond turning machine on hand, and most people don't.
Yep.
And then you had to get coatings done. And that isn't cheap either, especially if you're doing a one-off. So, you know, I don't know if you know how optical coatings like this work, but these are done in either a sputtering machine or an e-beam machine. And these are really cool. These are vacuum chambers. And in the case of a sputtering machine, you have, and it's a really intense vacuum. And in the case of a sputtering machine, you have a basically a block, a chunk of the material that you want to deposit onto your lenses or surface. And this is basically the case with any mirrored lens that you see. So this is pretty cool to think of when you see these lenses. It isn't just painted
what are their
on
mirrors?
Or sprayed on. I mean, even sunglasses.
What are their mirrored lenses? Oh, okay. Okay.
Right. So
just to get an idea of what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. So it isn't actually that exotic a process, but it's not that well known by lay people, I think. I wasn't familiar with it. So they then shoot. So you have your lens facing this block of material that you want deposited onto it. And then they shoot an electron gun at this block of material, and it causes, you know, atomic or molecular scale bits of this material to come flying off in the opposite direction and stick to the object that you want coated. And then with an e-beam, they're actually, so that's an electron beam, they're vaporizing the material that they want, and then it sort of uniformly coats everything in the chamber, whereas with sputtering, it's this directional thing. Again, getting samples of this done is not so easy to do and pretty expensive if you're doing it at a small scale and you aren't at a research institution that might actually have this equipment in their labs. So
just to clarify, Noah, what are the basic components of the headset? So what do you, like, at a very high level need? It sounds like this kind of this display unit
So you have these reflectors, these lenses that are 50-50, have this 50-50 reflective coating on the inside of the lens. And then you have displays, right? Which, in the case of the reference design, were actually made for VR. So they are 1600 by 1440 each, right? So the combined resolution is seen by the computer you've got this hooked up to. Is 2880 by 1600, so pretty high res, and definitely. These particular displays are also 120 hertz refresh rate,
nice,
and very low persistence, very
what
low latency.
What kind of panel is it?
So it's made by a company called BOE, and it's an LCD. It's not OLED, so it's a very low persistence LCD. I don't remember the acronym for it off the top of my head, but there's it's a form of TFT.
Cool. Yeah, it's probably the stuff they put in those pretty new recent gamer monitors where they drive the graphics driver or the driver unit for the screen very high to those high refresh rates.
I think these are also going into some of the WMR headsets, the Windows Mixed Reality headsets.
Oh, interesting. Because they are LCD. Yeah.
Yep. These aren't terribly expensive at scale, but you can't even buy them as an individual. And as an individual in the West, BOE won't even talk to you. They're dealing with OEMs, right? Large scale manufacturers. So you have an impossible to source display and a very hard to make, although not that exotic reflector, right? So
but that explains a lot why it's not that widespread, right?
Yet. Yes, why it's not widespread yet. And then you have a display driver PCB. Now, there are a bunch of off-the-shelf display driver boards that you can get, and people are using them for other variants of the North Star. None of them are capable of driving this display.
Yeah, it's a pretty high resolution plus frame rate.
Yep.
Wasn't there recently a company announcing like new display drivers that would handle, I don't know, like 8K, 120 frames or whatever for those VR headsets? So there is something happening, but again, how do you source it, right? You only can get it in a big bulk.
Yeah, I mean, so people have actually been doing North Star variants based on torn down WMR headsets. So people are taking apart Windows mixed reality headsets and using the parts to build North Stars, which is kind of cool because it also has the inside out six DOF tracking, right? So they're adapting it to for use with that as well. I know one guy, actually the admin of the North Star Discord server, has just recently completed one of those. But Leap Motion designed their own board based on an Analogix 7530, I think, driver chip. And Analogix is probably also the company making that 8K display driver IC. I'm not sure, IMAX. But
right.
I wouldn't be surprised. But
you can't print it yourself, right? You need to source it somewhere, or does it need to be printed?
So the PCB, the display driver PCB.
Yeah.
It has some pretty tough requirements, tolerances. It's got 1 millimeter vias, so that's drilled, coated holes, plated holes that are 1 millimeter across, and that most PCB houses in the US and even most of the easily accessible PCB manufacturers here can't do that. Their equipment just doesn't support it. Again, it isn't just a matter of ordering it and then assembling it. It's also hard to get the Analogix chips. This $100.
Part, the frame, then?
Well, so the frame is 3D printable.
Right.
So nobody's mass producing the frames as far as I know so far, although...
Yeah, but you could go to an online, 3D print service of your choice.
Yeah, you could just go to Shapeways if you're in the States. I think they might be global at this point, and then there are lots of them here in China.
Why do you think Leap Motion doesn't actually provide a store with, DIY kits? Because, it's very nice of them to release it, and it's no mean of critics, but, is it some kind of natural filter they built in so non-tech people can't build it?
No, man.
We're focused on other things. I mean, so what I've heard, my impression is that they're real perfectionists over there, right?
Oh, they are. And that I heard it from a lot of points, yeah.
And that they were even hesitant to release the reference design as it was. So they may have been considering making kits, but I think the idea was ultimately that companies would take this reference design and make derivative commercial products from it, right? That it wasn't going to be this hobbyist thing.
No, that makes definitely sense. What kind of tracking does your headset has right now?
Okay, well, I'll get to that in one
because
second.
That's also kind of strange.
So I'm actually about to start selling kits, and I think part of the reason why they didn't jump straight into doing the kits was because I told them I was going to. The reflectors were hard to make and hard to get, and this $100 reference design ended up. It was going to end up costing $800 to build, and something like that. So I said, screw this. What's the point of that if people are going to have to pay so much for it? you know, I could, you know, I end up calling up Edmund Optical and asking how much it was going to cost to get these reflectors made. And I said, you know what? I'm in Shenzhen. I'm just going to have an injection mold made. And so I searched around for a company that would do it inexpensively enough that I could afford it. Mm. And that was confident in their ability to do an optical grade mold, and took them about a month to do. And so I had blank reflector samples out of that, you know, pretty quickly after making.
You're probably in the only place, but you're literally in the only place on Earth probably where you could pull it off, right? I mean, Shenzhen is literally like the hub for innovation. I mean, like 1/3 of those Kickstarter projects that actually are quite interesting and succeed come from Shenzhen.
At least.
I mean, it's a gut feeling. I don't know. It's 30%, 90%, who knows? But like, I mean, there are so many
documentations
about it.
Yeah. No doubt.
So, right.
So Noah, I mean, actually going back to Peter, what you were saying, why doesn't Leap sell kits? If they wanted to sell this headset, they wouldn't sell kits. They would sell an actual thing. Or what they were trying to do with, you know, Dragonfly and their mobile sensing unit is that they were trying to partner with and license with OEMs to actually build it out.
Exactly.
I think to do that, you need a significant amount of capital, which it sounds like that's kind of was the big, like, that's like the limiting reagent, right? It's if they were able to, if they had those billions of dollars to build it out and actually to have a whole supply chain of secure to build these things, they would have done it. But it's very expensive to do it. And if they can't afford to do it, then why not, you know, open source it and see what hackers can do. But that's interesting.
It's definitely a great attitude, yeah.
Yeah, sure. We didn't realize that you were also thinking about mass producing, but at least perhaps selling
all the parts necessary. Yep. So that's actually in the works. It actually got delayed by Chinese New Year, which just wrapped up. But as far as I know, this is the only headset outside of Leap Motion that has the originally prescribed displays, right? This is the only one to Leap Motion spec, right?
Wow.
So it has
this cool.
It has the BOE displays in it, and it has the Leap Motion designed display driver board in it. And I've got 100 of those boards in production right now.
Nice.
And so that's enough for 100 kits. I'm about to do another production run of the lenses, hopefully with improved coatings, and I'll bundle them all together and, you know, sell it for 200 something bucks, I think.
So that's awesome. And obviously we want to know about it when you do start selling these or put up a link. We'll share it to our.
It'll be long before this podcast actually gets published.
Oh, great. Even better.
The links for ordering the lenses and the displays are already up. So I've got a supply of the displays. The lenses are already shipping out to people. So I sent off a whole bunch of sets for that North Star meetup in Japan for them to give out free to students. And then nice. And then a bunch of people have also bought them.
These developers in Japan that you said 10 to 11 of them, I'm looking at the picture right here. Of their headsets, you said you're the only one that's using the prescribed like display unit. How else have these developers or these hackers have been making their headsets?
They're sourcing other displays. The first iteration of mine used displays from Sharp, also made for VR headsets, and there are easily sourceable driver boards for that. Mm. But that doesn't fill the entire field of view of the reflectors. So, and one of the big selling points, as it were, of this headset is the field of view, which just blows everything else out of the water.
So let's talk about it. All right.
Peter. Field of view and stuff. Maybe you tried the Meta 2. Could you compare maybe the HoloLens, the Meta 2, to what you see visually regards the field of view, the sharpness and everything else? Because
Yep.
I think it's just hard to imagine it.
So horizontal field of view is pretty comparable. I think it's actually slightly narrower than Meta's, but the vertical field of view, which is something that people don't talk about, is tremendous. And there's a graphic and illustration that I can send to you guys later, and it is it makes such a dramatic difference. All of these AR platforms, right? You are basically looking at a letterbox window, and which doesn't really make sense for real-world hand-based interactions. So with this headset, you can reach up and grab something. You can interact with something on your desk without pointing your head down. You can glance down and move your hands around. You can grab something on your desk and put it up on a shelf above your desk without moving your head, just swiveling your eyes. And that is so dramatically different from every other AR headset that I've tried.
I'm going to see if I can find some interesting videos from your Twitter page, actually. You've been posting some great clips of you using this headset, which is kind of how I got introduced to you. It's just you've been putting some really cool videos on Twitter. So the vertical field of view is something that is rarely talked about. And in fact, the first time I realized that its importance was when I tried the Star VR1 headset, which has a extra wide field of view, both horizontally and vertically. And I was like, oh, like I can see my hands and I were like, I can see my feet or like what, where I'm about to walk to. And I can see the sky. I mean, in a VR sense, it's slightly different than perhaps sitting on a desk, but tell us a little bit about the experience of how this headset works. I mean, to the layman or not to the layman, but to someone that knows nothing about AR, you know, they're going to be, you know, they're thinking like, why would I care about this hacking unit versus a fully all-in-one, either HoloLens or Magic Leap? I can understand where they're coming from, but I think the main thing about why we care about this hacking unit is because the fidelity of the interactions that you can have is just on another level, right?
Yeah.
Does it feel that way?
Yeah, well, I mean, the centerpiece of the interaction, right, to begin with, is the, you know, is the Leap Motion controller itself, right? Which, as far as I know, is still the gold standard for hand tracking. And actually, another anecdote, I was the first person to put a Leap Motion on a VR headset, actually. If you nice. Go on Thingiverse
really?
And look up, yeah, if you look up Oculus Rift Leap Motion, and go back to the oldest entry, I made a little 3D printable mount so that you could stick a Leap Motion on a DK1. And as far
way
as I know,
when.
I was the first person to do that. And
back then they didn't have a VR focus. They started actually, you know, way before the VR hype basically came in. So they had like those laptop integrations and stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, yep. Interesting.
And So of course that's a great thing to be able to build on, right? And then for hand-based interactions, it's just fantastic. Which is why it's so critical that it has this wide field of view. You're not using a 3DOF pointer or even a 6DOF tracked controller.
Right.
You want to be able to use this thing, anywhere you can see your hands, and which is something that I care a lot about. Obviously, otherwise I wouldn't have gone to the trouble of sticking one on a Rift way back in the day, and that first data glove that I built, 10, 11 years ago, was because I had this fantasy about, okay, I'm going to have a VR or AR headset. And I hate to do the whole first person shooter trope, but I was like, okay, you know, that's really cool. I can, you know, dual wield and everything. But I want to be able to pull a John Woo and stick my hands out in opposite directions, you know, look at one hand, turn to the other, and pull the triggers simultaneously. And unless, you know, you're not going to be able to do this outside, in a gaming scenario, unless you have a mocap system of some sort, because a sensor mounted on the front of your headset's not going to see it. And obviously, this headset still isn't going to see that, right? But the point is the range in which you can track your hands really matters a lot. So it's a really good place to start with this headset. You know, we want a field of view that's going to be able to display a good portion of the range of what the Leap Motion controller can capture. Yeah. And actually, the Leap Motion controller has a wider field of view than the displays. So anywhere within that visible area, your hand is tracked.
And this is still the original like 2010 or 2012 release Leap Motion hardware unit, yep. I believe, right? That's when that's been the same. I don't know if they've had minor refreshes, but it's almost all exactly the same. And they just update the software and their hand tracking, even throughout the, you know, 3 years that this podcast has been out, we've seen it grow from, I forget what it was first called to the Orion, update to what it is today. But they are by far at the top of, you know, hand tracking still. Nobody has been able to catch up to them. Maybe they're behind, but yes.
Which is crazy. In a really good way. And the unit that I have in my North Star is the one that I pre-ordered like 6 years ago.
Nice. Actually got mine for free the first time I applied for like a developer program of like sending out a lot of them.
Yeah, I felt really like a real sucker for pre-ordering them when they started giving them out for free before I got mine. So my developer friends who applied for it, I was like, you know what? I paid for it. I bought two, you know. There's no way my friends who applied for this free program are going to get it first. And then I ended up, you know, getting mine months later.
So how does the tracking work?
That's the main variable, it seems like, that they haven't really thought through. And from their videos, were they using like a Vicon or OptiTrack type of system? OptiTrack, yeah. Right?
They might have been. I think they may have just stuck a Vive tracker on there.
Okay.
No. In the videos that they have, they use an optical system. Okay. They have those tracking balls attached to the headset.
With the ping pong paddles the retroreflective kind of dots. But
because it's very easy to implement. I think that was amazing. If you have something you want to make trackable, working with those quite expensive OptiTrax, whatever systems, it's actually gives you, if you have it, a very easy way to.
Yeah, but a Vive tracker,
it's a lot more expensive. Totally,
right, yeah, honestly. And a Vive tracker could do the same thing if you have the same controlled environment, right? You have a wherever my lighthouses are now, but that would work. So it seems like you have a structure core sensor on top of your Leap Motion. Nice. Yeah, let's take a look at it again.
Yep. So this is a sensor from Occipital, right? And here, so it's this part right here. I'm actually going to pull this off so I can.
It almost looks like the Intel RealSense. Sensor, actually, that's what very much reminds me of, or Z Mini.
Yep.
Is it a time of flight?
So
it looks like 3D, right?
No. So it has stereo IR cameras, and then has a very wide field of view fisheye camera here. The actual depth sensor on here doesn't have that wide of field of view. And I've shot some video of it sort of ironically through Leap Motion's camera. So, which is something that I and they are trying to deal with at the moment. So I'm going to be upfront.
Is there interference?
There's some crosstalk. And so the demos that I've been doing right now, the hand tracking is a little more jittery than without it. And So I'm not terribly happy about that. And it sort of forces the Leap Motion to switch modes to try to correct for the fact that it sees an active IR light source in its field of view.
And not so you have interference, that, is okay.
It's a pulsing one, right? So the hand tracking gets especially bad when your hand is within that the captured the depth camera area. So it's actually working.
Why wouldn't you use a different depth camera? So maybe one based more on the stereo that creates you a point cloud out of the parallax?
Right, I might.
Like similar to the mixed reality?
Yeah. Well, because so
I'm not sure if Leap Motion can fix the interference, right? I mean, they both rely on infrared,
so,
I would assume.
Okay. So first of all, I don't want you to judge the structure core based on this fact, right? Because
No.
Because
the firmware is amazing,
because the firmware is a work in progress, right? And it also may be possible to apply a filter film to Leap Motion.
Yeah.
To the Leap Motion. When I first told Occipital, you know, about this crosstalk, right? They hadn't tested for it, and their response was, seriously, Leap Motion isn't filtering that wavelength. So they were surprised by it. And they were really eager to see the structure core mounted on a North Star headset. And were surprised when there ended up being that crosstalk. So in terms of how the depth sensor on it works, I don't know if you've encountered the original structure sensor. So the original structure sensor was based on that same PrimeSense tech as the original Project Natal, you know, Kinect. So it's shooting an infrared laser through a holographic diffraction grating that is producing a non-repeating pattern, right, onto the environment in front of you or in front of it. And then using an IR camera to interpret the deformation of that pattern. Mm-hmm. So the original structure core was based on PrimeSense technology, and Occipital ended up actually becoming the maintainers of the OpenNI repo after Apple bought PrimeSense. The sensing in this is no longer directly, you know, it doesn't have any components in common with the PrimeSense tech, but is still using that infrared projection, laser projection through the diffraction grating to produce that pattern. And then what's one of the things that's different about this is that it has stereo IR cameras, so it's interpreting that pattern from two perspectives, and that does make a difference. And then they're also doing optical slam using that fisheye camera in there as well, and then they're fusing all of that data. So
that's
it's a pretty
advanced, yeah.
So it's a pretty sophisticated sensor. They also have, and those are synced up, the IR cameras are synced up, global shutter IR cameras.
Nice.
And then they've got an IMU in there as well, right? And
okay, that's quite a good deal, yeah.
Yeah.
So, no, I mean, it sounds like there might be multiple kind of solutions to positional tracking, and if you're going to be, you know, selling kits to developers, has this been the most optimum one for you, or would you recommend, or like, you know, try to recommend for developers to experiment with, like, let's say a Vive tracker or OptiTrack, or maybe even I don't know if you've experimented with like the Zed Mini, the RGB cameras.
I don't have a Zed Mini, but I'm certainly interested in trying it. It gets talked about a lot on the Discord server, right? Which seems to be the sort of center point of the North Star community is the North Star Discord server.
We'll have to link it as well.
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. So there is lots of talk about the Zed Mini. I'm the first person in there to get their hands on a structure core. I really do like the tracking. The fact that there is some interference between it and loop motion sensor is obviously a problem. And there's, you know, looking for an alternative hand tracking solution, I don't consider an option because that would be incredibly bad form to take their reference design and cut their sensor out of it.
No. That's what makes the North Star the North Star is
is leap motion. And so so that's not even something I'll entertain. And largely because it would set a bad precedent for, you know, I obviously care a lot about open source hardware. It would set a bad precedent for other companies considering open sourcing their projects that have real commercialization potential. So,
fair enough. Okay, so I mean, we're I think crossing over an hour here. What are your overall thoughts when it comes to this headset? I think that's what I want to get to at this, to wrap things up with this conversation is you're a developer, you've used head mounted displays for a long time. And you're one of the only people now that I think has been using kind of a higher fidelity version of augmented reality, even if it's not both visually, right? Field of view is wider, but also the UI and the interaction system itself is higher fidelity. You also have a Vuzix Blade, you have other, you know, smart glasses. Kind of give us what your overall thoughts are about how you see this North Star, how it fits into a developer's tool bag, and what are the benefits that come from that?
Okay. So in terms of class of headset, it's sort of in the same class as the Meta 2 was. I'm not sure how to state that. In that it is tethered, right? The sensors and the Unity integration on this, I actually think, are better, but, I never, actually owned, a Meta 2, which is kind of funny because I designed the IMU board for the first iteration of the IMU board for the Meta 1, but, so this is, in that it's a tethered headset needs to be connected to a PC, it's sort of in that same class. That said, the vertical field of view makes a huge difference, as does the low latency of that display path, right? And the fact that it's built around a leap motion and has, you know, hand tracking as its primary interaction method rather than sort of added as an afterthought. I know in the case of the HoloLens, you know, that was its primary interaction method, but it was so simplistic.
I haven't found anyone who likes it, so.
Yep. And then.
Dude, I will defend them why they did that. Like, and it's not a great interaction, but if you think of it from their perspective as in, okay, we have Windows 8 or Windows 10 or whatever it was when they released, we need to make something that works with the input systems of Windows right now, which is a keyboard and a mouse, right? If your gaze can be the mouse, we just need a click. And so the easiest thing we can do with hand tracking for a dev kit is that maybe I'm making excuses for them and I wouldn't be making these excuses for other companies, but I just think it's not a great place to be like in the future, but I think given where we were, it made sense to do just a click to work with the Windows.
With the new versions, it would have some kind of 6 degrees of freedom controller because it would make so much sense. But now let me ask you a question. Do you think that we are about to kind of discover and not invent what augmented reality will basically do with us and what we will do with it? Because sometimes I have an impression, like let's say with Twitter, right? Someone who invented Twitter, or people who invented Twitter, they kind of built something that accidentally became quite huge. It wasn't like, you couldn't never foresee how Twitter itself, and when you looked first at it, would, you know, blow up so much. And the same goes kind of with those smart assistants, right? With all those kind of Exas and Google Voice assistants, right? They're all kind of really clumsy, yet people clock to them. 100 million of those Alexa devices are basically sold, right? So people seem to want them, and I have them too. Yeah, you heard it today during the podcast, but they're still not perfect. And it seems like there is a lot of people like you are going a lot of efforts through a lot of efforts to build something that kind of fits our vision. And there are a lot of companies flocking around it, and everyone has kind of their own vision. It seems like at some point we will come closer to what it actually is for us, what it makes with us, what we want from it. Because clearly, like when you describe this interaction, when you have like, you know, your two hands and you shoot left and right, that resonates with me. And I think it resonates with a lot of people to have this ability to interact with the space. Is this what drives you? And is this where you basically take out your motivation for building those things because you think that this is future? Or,
well, I'm very curious to see what people are going to do with it. I've had my own fantasies about what you can do with AR for a very long time. I've been inspired by a lot of fictional works. You guys mentioned Lane, the anime series, but even more relevant and maybe less well known is a series called Denno Coil. If you guys haven't seen it, make a point of checking it out. It's from a while ago. It's D-E-N-N-O-U, I think. So Denno Coil really addressed the future potential of AR quite well, quite a long time ago. There's also a book called Rainbow's End by Werner Vinge, which used to be referenced a lot. In fact, he was one of the keynote speakers at one of the early AWEs back when it was ARE. So these are both, pretty, you can get a lot of inspiration out of those. And for me, what I'm really inspired the possibility that inspires me the most these days, I'm less of a gamer nowadays, is data interaction, data management. And, you know, because I'm dealing with that a lot in, you know, in the manufacturing business, in product development and manufacturing, there are a lot of complex processes. Also, if I were running a business, and I've pitched this idea to the CEO of Noah Labs as well, you know, being able to see all of the moving parts, as it were, cash flow, contracts, and all of that visualized,
predictive maintenance.
Yep, visualized spatially around you, rearrangeable, and manipulable with gestures. I think would be much easier than at a computer with a keyboard and mouse for you know, and VR is already very good for that, for spatial data visualization, although I haven't seen as much of it as I'd like to. But also being able to use it, you know, even in the office, when it gets scaled down to a set of smart glasses, right? When something in the form factor of a Vuzix Blade or North Focals, right?
Yeah.
Has the same visual stereoscopic visual display capability that North Star has.
Do you think it's possible?
And Magic Leap is already getting there, right? I know. We all love to hate on them, and I made a big point of it for a while, having not actually tried the headset based on other people's, based on the fact that they hadn't released the optics that we all sort of expected and so forth. And then at CES a month ago, I got to try one and got to play with Tonandi and everything. I was like, you know, this, the field of view is narrow, it's small. But this is a pretty small package, and there's focal depth variability, and nobody else has that yet. There's also, you know, Nreal is a Chinese company that's making.
I was just about to ask, in terms of your opinion on how China is actually, how, first of all, culturally, like, how do you think AR fits into like the Chinese culture, especially in like Shenzhen? Like, do people look at you if you're wearing any kind of, you know, smart glasses on the street, especially things that look like they're smart glasses? And perhaps also if you can also comment on like Nreal and some of the AR headsets that were announced at CES in 2019.
So, I mean, I think Nreal is, they're sort of the ones to be taking most seriously. And I got to try out, so the current ones are just sort of micro display based pass-through optics, a lot like Osterhout Group was using and
ODG.
And so forth. But it still isn't variable depth. That said, at AWE in a closed off conference room, you know, in one of the demo suites, I got to check out a modulated light field display that they had there. Now it was bolted down, and they were, you know, showing a little virtual creature jumping from the top of one soda can to another, and you know, but the depth variability was very good. So they aren't,
that's good.
You know, they have stuff in the works and are worth taking seriously.
Yeah, the reason why I wasn't impressed by the variable focal display of Magic Leap is because I had a year and a half before that I had tried the Avogant mixed reality light field display that they kind of wanted to license, or I think they're still working on that, on licensing to other OEMs, but that had real continuous focal, so like whatever, you know, I had something way up close to my nose to something across the room, and I could actually switch focus, and I had correct blur and bokeh, and it had, you know, it didn't need eye tracking to do that. It was real continual off eye focus. So if we're talking, it's I don't think many people have, seeing that and then seeing, oh, you have two very discrete focal planes with waveguides, and throw a second waveguide in there and call it a light field. And we went into this on a very deep on a podcast in terms of like just looking into the terminology that Magic Leap was using.
Oh my God, photonic light field chips. What? Yes. Uh-huh. What the? You know, I don't know what your cursing policy is on this podcast. So I'm not going to do it. But that's a real WTF. I was just like, call it by what it is. And actually, that's what bothered me most about them is they're really telling this story about how they're inventing spatial computing. I'm like, they've been using the term spatial computing in academic papers for decades now. Augmented reality is a well-established field academically.
Yeah.
You know, the ISMAR conferences, you know, the IEEE International Symposium on Augmented Reality has been around for a long time. And, you know, that people like, you know, Stephen Feiner at Columbia, right, has been working on this stuff for a very long time, doing, you know, interaction studies and coming up with best practices.
Yeah.
You know, for you know, and he was funded by Microsoft long, long before the HoloLens came out. And so, you know, Magic Leap is like, we're exploring best practices for spatial computing interactions. It's a completely new thing that's never been done. I'm like, no, it has. There is a huge body of research, and there are academics who have been working on this for a very, very long time.
They mostly work at Magic Leap because they hired actually a lot of academics. To be honest, what's so magical about Magic Leap is the fact that they managed to pull it off, right? I mean, you look at the Project North Star and you see what's today basically doable with the demand that is there, like, you know, a few nerds and, you know, a few enthusiasts. And same kind of was with the DK1. I mean, the DK1 was kind of, you know, it was definitely not for everyone. And it was just, you know, to get it into hands of people who kind of understand the future. With the Magic Leap, they kind of jumped in front of the train. And now there is kind of a very crazily industrially properly designed device. I mean, I hold it in my hands. The way it's built, like even when you look at iFixit's teardown, it's crazy.
It's amazing.
It's beautiful. It's a masterpiece. It's almost, of engineering.
It's almost too beautiful for a development kit, which is what someone exactly. was saying. Is like if it looked worse, people would judge it less harshly. You know. Yeah.
But the question is, why do they have it?
It doesn't
why
did deliver they build the experience. It right now?
Yeah, it's also too expensive for developers. It's kind of doesn't fulfill its purpose. So the question is, why did they have it in the first place? Because there is no particular reason right now, unfortunately, even though it would be amazing if we would be ready for it.
And no, go for it.
Well, I was going to say, I actually use this a lot. I see the North Star as potentially being the DK1 of AR, right? In that it's inexpensive. The DK1 was incredibly cheap. For what it was at the time. There was nothing like it for that price point, or really at all. But and it was accessible. Developers could impulse purchase this, right? So while I was one of the first, backers of the DK1, I actually hadn't heard about the project ahead of time. Friend of mine, Chris Grayson, actually called me up and said, "By the way, the Oculus Rift campaign is live. They're taking orders now." I'm like, "What the hell is that?" And he's like, "It's a VR headset. It's going to change everything." You got? And I was like, "Okay, cool. $300? Yeah, order. Boom. Total impulse buy." And you can't do that with a Magic Leap 1. It has to be a considered purchase. And with the North Star, it sort of still needs to be a considered purchase if you don't own a 3D printer. But if you do, it's just a no-brainer. It's like the coolest 3D printed project you can make. If you have a decent computer and a 3D printer, you buy the parts from me, hopefully. And you're up and running.
It's like there are any other people offering parts, right? I mean,
no,
I don't think anyone has a choice.
At the moment, that might not last. But at the moment, I'm the only one producing the lenses. Only one producing.
Look out for the shipment that's going into the headquarter of Magic Leap. I guarantee you, they will order one, right?
Obviously, you can't divulge the identities of companies that have ordered this from us so far, but because they're placed through a store page, right? It's not like they call me up and ask for it. So Noah Labs has a sort of a retail offshoot subsidiary, and so I'm having them do the fulfillment. Obviously, there's a privacy policy in place.
That makes sense.
But there are a lot of names purchasing the parts for this.
Great. I can imagine, and I'm sure I'm hoping to see more of these on my Twitter feed. So to our listeners, if you're interested and would like to mess around with hardware, that this would be cool to work with. So we promised earlier in the episode to talk about the HoloLens 2 and to kind of give our quick thoughts or perhaps rumor speculations before the announcement, which is in a few weeks. So I'm just going to read this off of Tom's guide in terms of what rumors. There's been very little rumors, surprisingly, about the HoloLens 2. Microsoft has kept it very well locked down, but supposedly it's going to have a wider field of view. I think that's probably going to be on top of everyone's list. This one says from 35 degrees to 70 degrees. That's a 2x increase. A Qualcomm Snapdragon inside with, I think even they're saying that perhaps an LTE connection.
They'll probably jump to the new Snapdragons as they release for VR and has LTE.
55, okay.
So it's not the XR1. Beefy. It's not the XR1. It's the 855. I think this is confirmed.
Okay, that's great to know.
It's really beefy. Yeah. Actually a desktop chip, right? It's designed for laptop.
What, the Snapdragon 855?
I think the 855 is actually for, or maybe I'm
I think it's still mobile,
well, but it's pretty beefy.
Yeah. It's incredibly powerful. But AR requires a lot of horsepower. I mean, it's analyzing a lot of things Very more so than VR.
But analyzing happens, as far as I understand, at least on the HoloLens one, more on the FPGA side. So I know that the sensors that the Microsoft HoloLens one uses produce like 1 terabyte of data per second, and it's being jumped into a custom SoC, so system on a chip, which then basically derives a lot. Because, I mean, they were stuck using an Atom. There is no way an Atom can process 1 terabyte of data, you know?
Well, so, I mean, with the, I think starting with the Snapdragon 835, Qualcomm introduced circuitry that's specifically for, so it may be, you know, an ASIC essentially embedded in the SoC,
like a reprogrammable part of the processor.
Yeah, for doing the VIO, for the visual inertial odometry. So, you know, you don't need a secondary specialized ASIC or FPGA.
Also, the HoloLens 2 is going to have the new Kinect sensor, and I think the Kinect sensor has some kind of calculation unit on top of it. Right? They've shown it previously, like a year or two ago, I think.
Yeah, this is something that Microsoft Research showed. Their kind of new time of flight Kinect kind of sensor looked really clean and had much wider range. Yes. Because by the way, for our listeners, like, we had the Depth Kit, one of the co-founders on, and the Kinect 2 is still kind of one of the best depth cameras that you can get for to do like volumetric video with. Like the Intel RealSense is great for other applications, but less so when it comes to like clean human video feed with depth. So there's a lot there, and I know Microsoft has had a lot of improvements on it, but they just have not had a reason to release anything.
Do you think it will have a controller?
A controller, maybe. I mean, it's really hard to say. I think the biggest thing of this headset is going to be the display is going to be on a new generation optics, as well as the hardware that it's running on are just going to be like, it's kind of like the Quest of AR, like, you know, or like a DK2.
Do you think it will be the Quest of AR? Because so far Microsoft managed
that's probably
their
a bad
sheer
comparison.
Power.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be, but you see, there are like a lot of those B2B projects right now. You see like a lot of big brands, you know, bragging how they use HoloLens in their everyday, you know, mm-hmm. teaching people how to pick. Picking is a term from logistics where they pick together boxes. Yeah, sure, you take a 3,000 euro device, put it on someone that only runs 2 hours, that earns less than 8 euro per hour that he's going to pick, you know. That's probably not going to happen. The question that I always have in my mind is, HoloLens 2, will it be this device that will be actually usable?
It's good enough for the army. It's good enough for the United States military.
Yeah, but for the army, you can take... I mean, but the army is probably one of those instances where... you're ready to take any difficulties. I mean, look at how people operate missiles or whatever, like a shitload of buttons, right? So
no,
in
man,
a sense,
I think it's the opposite. Like the army would probably has higher in things need to work more and more consistently with users that know less about this technology. Like it's like probably even a harder use case to try to like design for. But I think a big advantage that Microsoft does have over Magic Leap is their enterprise focus, because like their headset doesn't have constricted field of view, doesn't have, you know, things that like OSHA would have problems with when it comes to safety regulations. So, yeah, I mean, this is going to be really, really interesting, especially for enterprise wanting to have an actual AR, you know, headset to build something for. So cool. Okay. I think we've gone through one last thing. I asked you I think I asked you two questions and you forgot the first one. Was, have you worn kind of like smart glasses or AR glasses around Shenzhen? And culturally, like, is that significant in China? Like do you think like China is more ready for AR than America is in some ways?
I think it is. And so I showed up in Shenzhen wearing Google Glass daily, and it was at the height of backlash against glass in the States, and nobody had anything negative to say about it. Everyone just thought it was really cool. Oh, what is that? And yeah, so I think they are more ready for it. And, you know, weird looking things are kind of okay here.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. America really in the West is like, I think has a wounded leg when it for AR, because everything is going to be compared to glass. So it's just it's a hard barrier to go over. So that's why people are trying to like completely circumvent it and go around and never even talk about, you know, AR or smart glasses. So from
a business perspective, though, there's actually a little bit of resistance to AR at the moment, because maybe a year ago or a year and a half ago, when things weren't quite ready, might even be longer than that, there was a big wave of AR investment. So there was a
muting Peter there.
Yeah. So there was a big wave of AR investment, and most of those startups, there was no actual substance to them, and a lot of them failed. So investment here tends to follow trends, whereas in the West, right, you're looking for something unique that other people haven't invested in yet. And it's like, this, you know, this hasn't been done. Whereas here, people, and I think this is totally backwards, want something that's proven. Oh, smartwatches are catching on. Smartwatches are a good investment. I'm going to find a smartwatch company to invest in. Whereas, of course, if the market already knows about it, this is my opinion, or actually my dad used to tell me this, if the market already knows about it, it isn't good investment intelligence.
Yeah, because people, it's already a thing that you're not capitalizing by being an early person. I think it's that's like a fundamental difference between American companies and Chinese companies, is American companies are vision driven and Chinese companies are like first and foremost profit driven in the beginning. You'll see what you're, you know, hitching your wagon to being different. So if you're profit driven, then you're most likely going to try to build something that already has a trend or like something provable that can create generate money now, even in the earliest stage of the company, versus in America, it's like, oh, you know, we can be visionaries and predict that in 10 years, this technology will have matured enough to be a profitable market and have investors, you know, support you until then. But there's interesting byproducts of both.
Yeah, and investors apply a lot of pressure pretty quickly here. They want to see returns pretty quickly. At least that's the prevalent culture right now. It's really hard to generalize about China, though, and Shenzhen especially, because things change. Things evolve here so quickly. I mean, and you know, in this city in particular, is the fastest growing city in the world.
That's a good point.
From one year to the next, it's hard to recognize.
I mean,
the city exists only since a few years, right?
30 some odd years.
A few decades.
And it's gone from a few hundred thousand people to, it's been a long time since there's been a census done, but it's estimated anywhere between 15 and 25 million.
Just nothing, yeah. Just a little bit of people.
Yeah, the fastest growing city. Fastest growing city in the history of mankind.
Yeah. That's pretty awesome. Okay, Noah, how can people find you, reach you, perhaps contact you about these projects?
Okay, so at the moment, probably the best place to see what I'm doing is, unfortunately, on Twitter. So it's my Twitter handle is N-O-A-Z-A-R-K, Noah Zark, no H. In there, so N-O-A-Z-A-R-K. Let's see, I don't have an up-to-date website about the project. I have integratedrealities.com from way back when, but I might start posting about it there eventually. But for the time being, Twitter's the best place to find something.
All right, and you can... Yeah.
Sorry. The best place for ordering the parts is smartprototyping.com, hyphenated. So smart-prototyping.com. That's where you can buy the parts, the lenses, the displays, the driver board. And I should have mentioned that much earlier in the podcast.
Yeah, we'll have a link for these. And Noah, if you can also help us find the link for the Discord group for the for the community as well, would be awesome. Oh, you got it already. Great.
Yeah.
And you can find the Research VR podcast on Twitter at ResearchVRcast. We like to post videos, clips, and all the good stuff that of our weekly episodes. And we also like to retweet our previous guests. So anytime there's like developments that they've been doing, interesting things that we know you guys would like, it's always populated there. Twitter is our most active place that you can see, you know, some of what's new. And we do have a very active Discord channel as well. We're nearing 200 members now. That one grew a lot quicker than to 100. And that's also where we have post episode discussions. That's also where you can suggest guests to come on the podcast and topics, as well as just random link sharing that we do. There is a shameless plug channel. So if you are a developer that's listening to this and you're working on something cool, something that you think, you know, Peter and I would like to see, or even the other listeners, the other VR AR, you know, pioneers would like to see and perhaps even collaborate on, that is why it's there. Go and throw your work in. We're happy to take a look at it and see it. I guess it's not maybe worth talking about it on the podcast, but we are doing a Patreon only stream. At least I am a short one this Sunday, which is going to be outdated by the time you hear this, because by the time you hear this, I will have moved and a lot of changes will have happened in my life. All of which I'll be happy to talk more about. But yeah, in the Patreon stream, I'm going to do like an AMA and talk a lot more about a photogrammetry. What I did in China, what I did in the desert in Nevada, and what I'm going to be doing for the rest of 2019. So, drones and photogrammetry, man, that's my bread and butter.
Nice.
Awesome. Cool.
I'm excited. So, thank you.
If you don't support us yet on Patreon, and you don't want to support us on Patreon, you could still spread around the news that we exist. Rate us, give us reviews, share it with your friends, force people to listen to it, basically print out our audio and just throw it out of the window so everyone can get a piece of that audio.
Like ticker tape on New Year's,
yeah,
on Times Square. Yes. If you like listening to this podcast and you want to help to keep the virtual lights on in the virtual room, find us on Patreon. We are hashing out of the tiers and rewards, but even it's as little as $2, I think, would be if you find more than $2 worth of value in this podcast every month, consider buying us half a cup of coffee. That would really, really be nice,
according to San Francisco prices.
Yes. I don't know if in Shenzhen can you get cheaper, better coffee for $2, Noah?
I think actually Starbucks is more expensive here, and good coffee is pretty pricey here because it isn't ubiquitous. You know, it isn't really a Chinese thing.
Right, exactly. It's a very much West. They're much more of a tea culture. I had some awesome tea ceremonies in China. Learned a lot. I really want to go back to the point that you just made in terms of like not overgeneralizing about China, because I really was like facing my own, I had my idea of how people in companies in China, tech in China function and what they cared about. And I was somewhat surprised as well. So that could be an entire other podcast for another day. So thank you again, Noah, for joining us. And hopefully we'll see you, we'll see more of your work in the future.
Thank you. Awesome. Peter, really appreciate it.
Great. All right. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Peace out.